government in Gaza killing innocent civilians under the U.S.'s watch. Ayatollah Khamenei also cited domestic unrest within the U.S. He pointed to the protests involving millions of Americans and advised Trump to solve the problems at home instead of lying and interfering in other countries' affairs. The leader emphasized that unlike Israel, that uses U.S.-made weapons, Iran produces its own missiles and military hardware and is prepared to use them again if necessary.
Israeli forces continue to violate the Gaza ceasefire agreement, with Hamas killing and injuring more civilians in fresh air and artillery strikes. According to Gaza's government media office, the Israeli regime has committed at least 80 violations since the Gaza truce deal entered into force, killing nearly 100 civilians and injuring 230 others. It added that the regime's violations include direct shooting at citizens, shelling of residential areas, and arbitrary arrests of a rat of civilians. The office stressed that Israeli violations were documented in all governance of Gaza without exception, proving that the regime is not committed to cease fire and continues to kill and terrorize the Palestinian people. The military wing of Hamas also announced that it has handed over the body of one of the Israeli captives that was recovered a day earlier. The death toll from the Israeli genocide now tops 68,200, with more than 170,360 others being injured. We were earlier joined by our Gaza correspondent, Muti Abu Musabbeh. He said the ceasefire agreement is only written on paper, but the reality is something else.
Today, in the eastern side of At-Tufah, Nabahout, after the Israeli occupation forces targeted a group of the Palestinian people, killing two Palestinian civilians and leaving several injured. In the meantime, further parts of Gaza witnessed more cruel and fierce attacks of the Israeli occupation forces targeting the Palestinian people, particularly in the eastern side of Deir Bala city here, whereas the Israeli artillery continued to shell and target the Palestinian people, like what happened also in the eastern side of Khan Yunis city, which is still one of the focal points of those genocidal and brazen violations of the ceasefire agreement. So we are still witnessing this systematic and constant pattern of the violations maintained cruelly and brazenly by the Israeli occupation force against the Palestinian people. Once again, those attacks are not taking place out of the blue. They are not taking place in vacuum. We are talking about a systematic policy maintained cruelly and deliberately by the Israeli occupation forces. But we understand clearly that till this moment, the Israeli regime is trying to create another fait accompli on the ground, to create a new status quo by continuing their attacks against the Palestinian people. And unfortunately, those attacks are not confined to the cruel attacks against the Palestinian people, because on the other hand, we are still witnessing how the Israeli regime is still restricting the flow of the humanitarian supplies into the Palestinian people, given the fact that the Palestinian people and the Palestinian population in Gaza is absolutely devastated by the catastrophic humanitarian conditions after two consecutive years of the genocidal war against Gaza.
Well, the Hamas, the resistance movement, has reaffirmed its commitment to the Gaza ceasefire agreement, stressing that it is Israel that is trying to undermine the truce. Hamas stressed that it is a fixed policy of the Israeli regime to continuously violate ceasefire agreements. The movement said it abides by the truce deal in Gaza, especially its first phase, and has handed over all living Israeli captives in one batch. Hamas noted that it is working hard to complete the handover of all bodies of the Israeli captives, but is facing major challenges due to the massive destruction in Gaza. The movement said one of the difficulties faced in handing over the captives' bodies is a lack of heavy equipment to remove the rubble, and it has been explained to the mediators. Hamas added that Israel is exploiting the issue of humanitarian aid to blackmail the Palestinians, and the regime has not abandoned its starvation policy against the people of Gaza. It urged all concerned parties to pressure Israel to fulfill its commitments if they want continued calm in the region. Author and journalist Eric Wahlberg joined us earlier. He said Netanyahu tried to break the ceasefire by claiming that Hamas has killed two Israeli soldiers in order to continue the genocide of Palestinians.
Israel said that the two IDF soldiers were killed, and they accused Hamas of killing them, whereas in fact it was unexploded ordnance that was killed these IDF soldiers by chance. And Trump apparently told Netanyahu, I know the story on this, you can't fool me, these were your own, this was your own problem, this was not Hamas. I don't know how far this will extend, but that is more hopeful than the fact that 90, apparently already Israel's killed 90 people and had 120 violations since October 10th. So it's doing its best to play the bad boy. So, and it's still continuing to starve the Palestinians. It's not letting aid in. So I think the media has to say, open Rafah and allow the aid in. That, I think that's got to be the number one at this point, so that the Palestinians can survive. We're still at the stage one, where we're trying to end this genocide. We can't get on to the day after until the genocide ends. So that's got to be the top priority of the mediators.
Another Palestinian abductee has died in an Israeli jail due to medical neglect and mistreatment by the regime's prison officials. According to Palestinian sources, 69-year-old Kamel Mohammed Mahmoud Al-Ajrami died at Israel's Negev prison due to worsening health conditions. Al-Ajrami was abducted by Israeli forces in Gaza last October. He was married and father of six children. His death brings the number of Palestinian abductees who have died in Israeli prisons since the start of the Gaza genocide to 80. His death also came just one day after another abductee, Muhammad Mahmoud Talal Abdullah, died in an Israeli jail after he was denied medical treatment. Palestinian Prisoners Society said killing abductees is an extension of Israel's ongoing genocide in Gaza. It stressed that hundreds of abductees released from Israeli jails have testified that they were subjected to torture, starvation, medical neglect, sexual abuse while in detention. We earlier talked to political commentator Robert Fantina. He said denying prisoners' rights is a common tactic used by the Israeli regime to humiliate and torture Palestinian abductees.
This is an ongoing and common tactic that the Zionist regime uses to humiliate and torture Palestinians who are imprisoned, and of course, by extension, their loved ones who don't know where they are, don't know what kind of treatment they're receiving. So this is typical for the Israeli regime. The fact that the world community allows this to happen, looks the other way, despite repeated testimony by Palestinians of the torture they receive in Israeli jails, the fact that hundreds of bodies that have been recovered from Israel are sent showing signs of torture, being shot in the head with their hands tied behind their back. This is inexcusable. These are violations of international law. These are war crimes. And this is business as usual for the Israeli regime by killing and torturing to death the prisoners who are entitled to basic rights under international law. By doing this, it is collective punishment. It is killing people because it's killing whoever Zionist regime can get its hands on to punish the rest of Palestine for resisting the occupation.
An Iranian academic illegally imprisoned in France over pro-Palestine social media post has been put in a prisoner exchange plan. This according to Iran's Deputy Foreign Minister Vahid Jalalzadeh. The official said Tehran has come up with a political and consular package that both countries must implement to expedite the release of Mahdia Isfandiari. He expressed hope that Isfandiari would return to Iran soon. The deputy minister noted that Isfandiari has been actually taken hostage by the French government, despite Paris's claim to be an advocate of the freedom of speech. He explained that Iran has taken all legal and consular measures since Isfandiari's arrest in order to secure her freedom. Isfandiari has been in jail since March for denouncing Israel's genocide in Gaza and the massacre of Palestinian women and children. Her case has sparked international outcry, with supporters slamming Esfandiari's politically motivated detention as a grave violation of the freedom of speech. Journalist and political analyst John Bosnich joined us earlier. He said the collective West punishes anyone who speaks out about the ongoing wars waged by the Western alliance.
Well, it's not just France, it's England, it's America, it's Canada, it's most of the NATO countries are punishing people who speak out against the ongoing wars of the Western alliance. And this is clearly a violation of her freedom of speech in France. It is a violation of the French Constitution, for sure. And the manner in which she's been transferred now for a prisoner exchange is an incredible admission on the part of the French government that they are playing war crimes politics with the lives of journalists, trying to shut the journalists up so that the truth doesn't get out, and at the same time pretending that a journalist telling the truth is a crime that can be compared to terrorism. This is a crazy, it's contrary to Western principles, and it's a fundamental violation of the principles on which the French Republic itself was founded. They've been shown to be streaking with their lies about freedom of speech. France has been shown that they have no free speech, that they imprison a person for making comments in social media. Canada has arrested people and seized their property. The United States is terrorizing people for saying things against the Israeli regime.
Well, crossing over to Yemen's capital Sana'a, thousands poured onto the streets to bid farewell to Chief of Staff Major General Mohammed al-Ghumari, his son and companions that were killed in an Israeli airstrike. The funeral turned into a display of unity, defiance, and renewed resolve amid rising regional tensions. Well, thank you very much, everyone. Bye for now.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we provide an in-depth and unvarnished analysis of Israel's criminal behavior and expose the Zionist lobby that tries to cover it up. In today's show, we'll be revealing Israel's attempts to facilitate the overthrow of Iran's government and install the son of the brutal Shah, who was ousted by the Iranian Revolution in 1979. In our first report, Latif Abouchaker sets out how social media and AI are being deployed to target young Iranians in particular to foment opposition.
Israel has been attempting to impose a continuation of the repressive Shah regime, which ruled Iran for decades. Now, the Islamic Republic. One aspect of this campaign has been digital manipulation. Iran has a young population who Israeli strategists believe to be vulnerable to manipulation via social media. Reza Pahlavi is Israel's agent in this campaign to bring back the monarchy to Tehran. Now, Israeli plots to astroturf support for the offspring of the Shah in Iran have been exposed by the Zionist newspaper Haaretz and the research group Citizen Lab. The campaign entailed fake online social media accounts utilizing artificial intelligence to manufacture Iranian support for Reza Pahlavi. The digital influence plot started after Reza Pahlavi visited the Zionist entity and escalated as Israel's genocide in Gaza began in 2023. The fake social media accounts pumped out tweets with the hashtag King Reza Pahlavi. According to the Zionist newspaper, the plot operates out of Israel but is funded by a private entity which is directly supported by the Israeli regime. One of the tweets even included a bizarre AI-generated video named Next Year in Free Tehran and depicted Pahlavi and his patron, Netanyahu, walking with their wives through the streets of the capital of the Islamic Republic of Iran, a campaign to incite unrest that would aid in overthrowing the regime was also discovered by Citizen Lab. The network's other propaganda included the assertion that Tehran is defenseless and a call for citizens to storm banks and take their money out. Additionally, Citizen Lab discovered Israeli-affiliated Telegram channels that promoted demonstrations in Iran, an X account, an Instagram page, and a Telegram group inviting Iranian women to share your story in a safe space, were all maintained by an avatar purporting to be an Iranian woman. However, after the Islamic Republic's victory over Israel in the 12-day war, Pahlavi unfollowed Donald Trump on Instagram. Trouble in paradise, perhaps? Maybe the pretender to the throne was upset he would not be parachuted into Tehran by the US Air Force, or even the Israeli Air Force.
As usual, I'm joined in the studio by David Miller, who's the UK's foremost scholarly critic of Israel and our resident expert. He's a co-director of the lobbying watchdog Spinwatch and a senior research fellow at the Centre for Islam and Global Affairs at Istanbul Zeyn University. Today's guest contributor is the Beirut-based award-winning journalist and political commentator, Leif Maruf, who established Free Palestine TV in 2023. Welcome to the show. David, what was Israel's relationship like with the original Shah regime?
Well, of course, I mean, the Shah in 1950 recognised Israel very quickly after the creation of the Zionist entity. That was then de-recognised when Mossadegh took over, and then of course Mossadegh was removed by Western forces, and they re-recognised Israel. In 1957, the CIA and the Mossad helped set up the brutal Savak secret police, which of course was famous for the torture it was engaged in, as you can see, the Savak Museum in Tehran to this day.
Yes.
So there was a very close relationship, and they had this doctrine that Iran would be part of the periphery, which would help to insulate the Zionists from external attack and from Arab unity. So it's been historically a very close relationship, and of course that was all cast asunder with the Islamic Revolution in 1979, and one of the first persons to come and see the new revolutionary government was of course Yasser Arafat and the PLO. So a complete change. Yeah. And now in the centre of Tehran you have Palestine Square, right outside where the Israeli embassy used to be, is now the Palestinian embassy. So you see the change.
Well, Leif, I mean, is there any support inside Iran for Reza Pahlavi?
Obviously, there is the old generation of Shah supporters that have left with the revolution, and they're mostly in the diaspora in the United States and California and what have you. And the generations that are there right now don't have any memory of the time of the Shah, so they're could be possibility of confusing some of the youth about what did it mean to have the Shah then. The other thing that we should note here is that the United States prefers to have monarchies as its experience over the last 60 years in the Arabic world is that the monarchies are the most stable, compliant vassals, and that in republics there is a possibility, of course, of change that is not so pro-American or pro-Zionist, and it's harder to control the situation, except with dictatorships, as we see in Egypt. So the preferred way of ruling an indigenous population in the Arabic or Muslim world for the United States is to have a monarchy, and this is why they are trying to bring back the Shah.
The other thing is that the other opposition that the United States depends on, the Mujahideen Khalq terrorists, they are also religious. At least this is what they project themselves. It's a cult. So it doesn't fit in the overall attempt by the West to de-religify the Arabic and Muslim people in order to make them easier to control through liberal propaganda.
Well, David, I mean, do you think Israel's running similar bot networks then in other countries? I mean, there's some evidence that they probably are, but what's your thoughts about that?
Well, you have to see the operations of the Zionists in terms of the full range of tactics which they use. In this case, these are bot networks, but the bot networks are, of course, complemented by many other tactics and techniques, including front groups and all sorts of other techniques, including, you know, direct subversion inside Iran. And that's, of course, the case with other countries as well. The Zionists have a massive operation in the US, as is very well known, in France and Germany, and in the UK as well. So there are literally thousands of front organizations being run from Tel Aviv in all of these countries, and presumably going alongside that, there will be bot networks as well, which have not so far been very well exposed, because that you expect that to be there, because they have a range of tactics, and they do. Usually, what they do is that they play all sides of an issue, not just both sides, but, you know, all sides of an issue, so that they can make most advantage of any possibility. So yes, I would expect that there is a bot network which we haven't yet discovered targeting the UK, for example, and one targeting the US, but that's in addition to the many, many thousands of other organisations and individuals, some of whom we'll talk about in a minute, I guess, who are themselves agents and assets of the regime.
Right, okay. Well, Nath, I mean, would you say it's likely that Israel's using Arabic language bots to target resistance groups in West Asia as well?
Definitely. If we take a quick look at Arabic Twitter content, it's clear that much of the content that is attacking Axis of Resistance members in the Arabic world is numbered accounts where the handle is easy to, you know, generate. It's not clearly not a real person. And much of this content is very sectarian, very anti-Shia, very pro-Wahhabi, and that indicates to you the main strategy of these bot armies that the Israelis and probably the Saudis, Emiratis, and Qataris paying for it also, is to create sectarian schism within the Arabic and Muslim regions. For the most part, it was successful up until actually the Aqsa flood, because of how the Shia Arabic communities were the main backers that sacrificed leadership, sacrificed populations, sacrificed land to defend the Sunnis of Gaza. So for this strategy of attempting to create a schism within the Muslim communities in the Arabic world around Shia Sunni has now failed. It doesn't mean that they're going to give it up. They are now concentrating on other aspects in terms of trying to create this schism, and it is mainly around the regional and location-based, you know, creating hates between Syrians and Lebanese and or Palestinians and Egyptians. So these armies are very active, and they are the majority of the contrarian and aggressive content that we see on the Arabic Twitter feed.
Well, David, is it significant, do you think, that the sources for these revelations about this AstroTurf campaign came from Citizen Lab and Haaretz?
Well, these are effectively, I'll explain this, liberal Zionist sources.
Yes.
Well known, but Citizen Lab, of course, was one the organization which exposed the NSO group and its Pegasus software. Mm. And if you look at its funding pages, as this on its own website, you can see that it's funded, for example, by the Ford Foundation, well known as a cutout, a pass-through for the CIA in previous years. but also by the Open Society Foundations, run by George Soros, again, liberal Zionists, who funds tons of liberal Zionist stuff, including, of course, famously J Street, the liberal Zionist lobby group in Washington, D.C. And then also another group which is worth mentioning is the Sigrid Rousing Trust, which is based in the UK, which also appears to fund a whole range of liberal Zionist groups, which more cleave to a CIA approach to stuff, including in this country. So groups like, for example, Hope Not Hate, funded by Rousing as well. So there's an indication there that there are groups which are funding Citizen Lab, which are effectively anti-Netanyahu, but which are pro-Zionist.
Yeah. Do you think there's sort of collaboration with the platforms that that host these social media bots, or is it they just sort of conveniently kind of using those? Or do you think there's more that these platforms could be doing to stop this sort of abuse, really, of the system and manipulating people in the way in which they're doing?
Well, they could do more to do it, and the reason we know that is because there have been times when they have done it. So in particular, there was a moment where Leif mentioned the Mujahideen-e Khalq, which is the religious cult which is anti-republic, and which had ran a pot farm for ages in Albania, and that was closed down after the Saudi-Iranian rapprochement, which the Chinese brokered, and one of the deals for that was that the Saudis had to stop funding Iran International, and that they had to stop funding the Mujahideen-e Khalq, and the police then went into there. Iran International is an indication, and we did some work on this, I think last year, we did a show on it, where we showed although it's a pro-Palamist network, the Saudis had stopped funding it as a result of the rapprochement, and the Israelis have taken over funding it, and that's why we were able to show the link between the Israelis and all these monarchist flags appearing on pro-Israel demonstrations in 2024, and in particular the individuals associated with those. So that was our indication, really, that the Israelis are starting to get heavily into this, and this bot farm thing is just a confirmation of that, really.
Okay, well, Nate, I mean, do you think Israel could succeed in bringing Reza Pahlavi to power in Iran?
I think it's an impossibility, because it's not anymore the 20th century, it's the 21st century. There's a two generations that lived without the direct rule of Shah, and I think looking at how the society in Iran came together during the 12-day war, there is an immunity now that the population has received because of this. People have seen what has happened in Syria with the collapse of the Assad government. People have seen what happens with minorities then in that situation. People also saw what has happened for 2 years in Gaza, the broadcasted genocide. So the generation that the West was depending on to cause internal strife in Iran, to dislodge its positionality against Zionism and imperialism, this generation now has lived also a direct attack on its own people and have seen how the Zionists are non-discriminatory in terms of their genocidal bloodlust.
Our next report reveals the way in which Israel has attempted to use social media platforms to manipulate public opinion in the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Data analytics group Social Forensics has exposed another online attempt to manipulate Iranians. This time it took place during the foreign-backed protests in Iran in 2022. Social Forensics has determined that the Islamic Republic of Iran was the target of cyber warfare operations during the protests. Social Forensics split the active accounts against Iran at the time into different sections. The accounts which were deemed to be the most influential at the time were the monarchists, those supporting the idea of Reza Pahlavi ruling the country. They would have the crown emoji in their username and supposedly represented the true voice of Iran on X. Social Forensics actually concluded that 95% of these accounts were sock puppets. Many official Israeli government accounts followed these fake sock puppet pages. For instance, one out of every eight accounts followed by the page @IsraelPersian turned out to be a fake sock puppet account, according to Social Forensics. There was also an investigation into Zionist propagandist Emily Schrader by Social Forensics. It was found that the website of her company, Social Light Creative, claimed that it worked with high-level government organizations and NGOs in Israel, including the Israeli military. The analytics firm, Social Forensics, also found that Schrader's follower account is inflated and her tweets are artificially amplified by the same inauthentic accounts. It seems like there is a digital ghost army fighting Israel's battles on the World Wide Web.
Well, David, then, so it turns out, then, that Israel was behind almost 100% of the pro-monarchy Iranian accounts on X during the riots in Iran that were widely reported on in the Western media.
Yes, and as you recall, when we said this at the time, that this was a CIA-led operation, yes, that the Zionists were involved, there was howls of outrage from parts of the Western left, and how could you say this is a genuine revolution? Yeah. No, not at all. Almost entirely fake from the outside, and by fake bots and trolls, including our friend here, Emily Schrader, who is a very famous asset of the regime, who we may talk about a bit in a minute. Mm.
It's amazing, isn't it, how the left seems to fall for this over and over and over again.
Well, it's a kind of it's mistaking the symptoms of revolution for actually revolutionary politics. So when people demonstrate in a country which is an official enemy and which can be regarded as being authoritarian or something like that, then people on the left say, "Oh, the West populist struggles," and they don't have any conception really that actually these things are fomented and are created by the CIA, by the Mossad, and indeed by MI6. There's a real lack of understanding about intelligence agencies' involvement in unrest overseas.
And of course, it's been going on for so long. Hopefully they will get the message eventually. But anyway, Leif, I mean, what kind of propaganda in the Arabic language is there about Iran?
There's, of course, a lot of propaganda that is sectarian, that is talking about the differences between Shia and Sunni and making them into unredeemable differences, which they are not. And of course, for a while, there was all the talk about how Iran is abusing the Palestinian cause or the Iranian government just to stay in power. Now, all of this has been diffused, as I said. Number one, with the clear sacrifice Iran gave to Palestine over the Gaza genocide and over the 12-day war, and that showed at the same time how all these Arabic regimes who have not sacrificed anything for Palestine are just creating this propaganda to create hate for Iran within the Arabic population. And simultaneously, that issue of Shia versus Sunni, for the most part, the Arabic population is now aware of this propaganda. Even the fall of Syria, which was very tragic and caused a lot of problems for the axis of resistance, simultaneously, it may have been a blessing, because with the fall of the Assad government, having seen the Arabic propaganda saying that the Al-Julani and the Wahhabi death squads would go and liberate Palestine, and that only the Syrian government is standing in their way, well, now we have 9 months of clear record of collaboration of the Julani government and the Wahhabi death squads with the Israelis after the fall of the Assad government, and that no aid came to Palestine from these militias. So a lot of the propaganda that was built up over the last two decades around the issue of Syria have now disappeared, and things are much clearer for people. I think it's going to take both the Zionist and the Arabic monarchist vassals another generation to try to fool the Arabic population to hate Iran and hate the axis of resistance.
Absolutely, that's clearly the strategy, it seems. But David, I mean, you touched on Emily Schrader, I think, in your previous response. You'd say it's a bit more about this character, will you?
So I first came across Emily Schrader at a conference called the Digitel 2018 conference in Tel Aviv, which was put on by the Ministry of Strategic Affairs, which at that point had responsibility for global ASBAR. And she was one of the invitees there, and she'd come over from America, and she had dyed bright ginger hair, and you can see that in the interim period what's happened to her is that she's been put through Zionist image consultants, and she's her image has been softened, she's gone blonde, and she's now got into her intended to be husband, Yosef Haddad, who of course is an Israeli Arab, as he's called, I think he's Lebanese originally, who served in the occupation forces, and they pose as this couple who are about to get married, and they were flown and jetted into London, as you perhaps recall, in 2024, when they hung out with the Palavists on the pro-Israel demonstrations, waving the monarchist flag, and trying to pretend that they were there defending the right of Israel to defend itself and all that kind of stuff. So she is a paid Israeli operative, and the package there shows very clearly the way in which those kinds of assets are integrated with the bot networks.
Right, okay. Well, briefly then, Leif, because we're almost out of time, what's the current condition, would you say, of the Axis of Resistance?
Well, after those huge losses of leadership and, both in Lebanon, Yemen, and Iran, and I think the situation in Palestine, we can see that the Axis of Resistance has reorganized in a different manner. There is clearly Iran is rebuilding any of its military capacities that it needs to address in an upcoming war that could be happening. I think the assassinations of leaderships, although sometimes they may create a imbalance in the beginning, with the entry of new leadership, especially military leadership, this brings ingenuity and innovation that wasn't there when you have a long-term leadership in position, and also will provide a lot of surprises that the Israelis, the Zionists, and the imperialists couldn't be calculating. So we always have to think about what's the silver lining, even in a situation like the huge losses that we had of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, Sayyid Safiyuddin, the leadership of the Yemeni government, or the leadership in Iran. All of those, because our nations are living and still resisting, could be considered actually blessings that bring us new life.
The resilience, I think, is pretty clear for all to see, Leif. But I'm afraid that is all we've got time for today. So I'd like to thank our guest, Leif Maroof, and of course our resident expert, Professor David Miller. But we'll be back next week with more revelations and information that you won't see on the corporate media, so make a date to join us again on Palestine Declassified. So until next time, bye for now.
is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, sacrifice. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to 8:30 here on IB English Radio with me, Sister Zainab. And well, obviously the topic of sacrifice, obviously we know is a very big one. And so what is it we're going to be talking about? So this is for, I'll just briefly mention something from the life of one of the famous martyrs of the Holy Defense, Shahid Mehdi Bakari. So for example, one of the anecdotes from his life is that, and this is probably, this might be common knowledge to many of the listeners, that the same night that he got married, that the actual contract was done, he actually departed for the front. And so this is a particular theme that we see for sure in the martyrs of the Holy Defense, and indeed in the lives of all of the martyrs, and in the lives of every single person, I suppose, who is trying to walk the very straight path and gain proximity to Allah, where obviously this attachment to material things sort of dissipates. It just falls away from these people, and they really do just want to serve Allah. And obviously that means that, you know, they cannot prioritize, let's say, spending extra time with their family. In the stories of one of the other martyrs from Holy Defense, the martyr was had, for example, cut short his stay with his family, because obviously they would get like some break every so often to just go back and be with the family. And this martyr typically cut short his stay with the family, and the daughter was even asking, why can't you just stay longer? And you know, the answer that the martyrs these people would give is that, you know, their comrades, their fellow soldiers, their friends need them. They should be there just to sort of lend moral support. Welcome back to 8:30 here on IB English Radio with me, Sister Zainab. And so I'm talking about sacrifice and the fact that in these particular situations that I've mentioned, for example, during the War of Holy Defense, that the martyrs would obviously prioritize serving, being with their fellow soldiers, to also, to sort of maybe put themselves out there, even before their fellow soldiers. So typically the commanders would actually sort of tell their fellow soldiers to sort of stay behind, so they would go out front first. For example, Shahid Dr. Mustafa Chamran, it was said of him that he would always be the first when it came to sort of fighting in the battlefront, and he would sort of encourage the soldiers to sort of be behind him, so he was prepared to sacrifice himself over and above sacrificing his fellow soldiers. And you know, this is, so what do we learn from this? So this is obviously the idea of sacrifice is something that we can implement in our lives. Obviously we're not at the battlefront, but this is about at the root of this is also in a sense a kind of humility, that we ourselves are not that special, that we put our lives, our things, ourselves above others, and that we really have this idea of serving others, because obviously in a sense, how can we serve Allah? One way we serve Allah, because Allah has no need for us, Allah is needless, so we can serve Allah by serving others. So if we are able to put others before ourselves, then this is one way of doing it. For example, and you know, even when we're giving charity, when we look at some of the sort of rationale in charities, that we're told in the Quran to give, and even give of that which we value, which is dear to us, so which we can also understand as well, things that are maybe the most precious to us we can give away. So it's this same idea to try to consider others and do the best for others before we even do something for ourselves. And I think that's something we can maybe take on board in our daily lives. So inshallah, these are just some points for us, and I pray that you tune in to another episode of A to Z here on IOB English Radio, and farewell for now. Thank you very much for listening to this episode of A to Z, and for more information, please also visit our website at www.iranradio.ir.
Practitioners who do not just treat trauma, they confront its root causes. They move between clinics and protest lines, blending care with conviction. The work challenges systems, amplifies silenced voices, and redefines what it means to actually heal. My guest today is one such practitioner whose outspoken views on U.S. foreign policy and support for Palestinian resistance have sparked both admiration and controversy. Welcome to SALT. I am Bahman Arai.
Jennifer Koonings is a psychiatric nurse practitioner and sexual assault forensic examiner based in New York City. She holds two Master of Science degrees and is certified in trauma-informed care, specializing in PTSD, anxiety, and depression. Her clinical work intersects with activism, particularly around Palestinian solidarity and anti-imperialist causes. In 2024, she joined the Gaza Freedom Flotilla, aiming to challenge the blockade on Gaza. Koonings has written for outlets like Common Dreams and Antiwar.com and gained attention for her hunger strike protesting the humanitarian crisis in Gaza.
Jennifer Koonings, very good to have you on this program.
It's great to be here.
Of course. Pleasure for us. What first drew you to the field of mental health and trauma care?
Well, not to get too personal, but I don't know, as a child, I was always very an emotive child. I was very sensitive, but I lost, my older brother got killed actually when I was 12 years old.
Oh.
He was 14, and that to me was just like such an impactful event in my life. It really shaped the course of my life and kind of like exposed me to this other side of the world of injustice. I felt, you know, as a 12-year-old, that my brother could be killed, and feeling the injustice of all of that, and feeling like, I was never given like the apology or just the explanation of why that happened ever. And that kind of like propelled me into always wanting to fight for the oppressed, and like realizing that when people lose someone that is close to them, like a family member or someone that they love, it's a very impactful and huge trauma that's not ever something that you can get over. So I would point to that.
I'm really sorry for your loss.
Okay.
That was a terrible shock to me in the beginning of the conversation. I'm really, really terribly sorry for your loss.
Well, you know, that's life. Like, look at what the people in Palestine are going through right now and what you guys have gone through. Like, you know, life is precious, and that also is something that drives me, because I know what, you know, I've had like a major loss. It's one person that was taken from me at a young age, but you know, seeing what's happening in Gaza, like people, children are losing their entire families. It's like a trauma that I can't even comprehend.
That is mind blowing,
mm-hmm.
Of course.
Yeah.
But tell me,
of course, you mentioned this personal experience. I wanted to see if there are any personal experiences shaped your decision to become a forensic examiner. So this would be, of course.
Well, so the forensic role that I had, actually, that was something that I became interested in college. I did crisis counseling and medical advocacy for sexual assault victims. Uh-huh. And that was actually the primary reason why I went into nursing, was to be able to be there for sexual assault victims in that way. And that's why I got into that.
Right. Mm-hmm. And how did your education at NYU and Hunter Bellevue influence your clinical philosophy?
You know, I wouldn't really point to any educational institution I went to as like positively shaping me. Like, I'm sure you guys are also well aware, like the Western educational systems have all, you know, sold out to corporate interests at this point, especially an institution like NYU that fired a good friend of mine actually for speaking up for Palestinian people and Palestinian mothers specifically. And I kind of just see them as, you know, I got my degree from them and I'm able to do what I want with them, but I wouldn't say that really any, you know, Western American educational institutions are really like bastions of ethics and morality.
Right. And what you do in your activism, of course, much broader than what you studied for in those universities and colleges. So
yeah, you know, it gives you like a very like singular view of the world, the Western lens on kind of like these issues that you have to see in a more like broader perspective, in a more broad perspective. And that's kind of like a framework and mentality that you can only develop like with your own experience, your own study. It's not something that you're ever going to be able to learn like from, you know, New York University.
Of course. And tell me, what does trauma-informed care mean to you in practice?
So trauma-informed care essentially is believing victims and listening to people's stories and recognizing that you as like the clinician are not the expert in what happened to them, and kind of like taking their lead and hearing what happened to them and supporting them, and also not blaming them for, you know, whatever happened to them, their trauma, and instead turning it around and asking the question, why is it that this victim was victimized in this way, and what about society allows perpetrators to continue to victimize people in this way, and like why haven't we stopped it? And actually that's a good lens, I believe, in examining the Palestinian issue, the Palestinian cause as well, because that's in Western media, Palestinians are always blamed, you know, for their genocide, for their suffering, and instead it's like why are they suffering? And they're suffering because of US imperialism.
And how do you think trauma specialists can help the Palestinian people in this situation? Do you think there is any care with that it would be possible to actually help those people?
You know, that's a tough question to answer, because I think the primary goal obviously is to stop the trauma, like to stop the genocide, to stop the Holocaust. And I think that Western kind of, I don't know, like framework and psychology and all of this is completely inept in even being able to address this type of trauma. The type of trauma that Palestinians in Gaza are experiencing is, it's not anything like that the DSM would be able to explain. And I'm sure that there are clinicians that can and will and are in this moment helping, especially like, you know, Palestinian children being able to process that, but I believe that that should primarily be Palestinian clinicians and Palestinian, you know, a Palestinian framework for that, not like coming from the US.
Yeah, sure. And how do you navigate the emotional toll of working with survivors of sexual violence?
Yeah, so I always get asked that question. And the role that I work in now, I'm a nurse practitioner. I work with women, homeless women, essentially. And it's a tough deal. You hear sad stories every day. I feel like I want to just cry my eyes out every single day, hearing just the horror that a lot of women, especially
right.
low-income women in the U.S. are suffering through and suffer through every day. And I don't know, like, it's sad, and of course it is, and that's kind of how I explain it to people that ask me, like, you know, life is sad, like, there's people suffering all over, but at least I feel in this role, like, that my work is important, and supporting survivors, supporting victims, and supporting people, women primarily, who are being oppressed, like, is so meaningful to me. So even though my role is sad and I hear a lot of sad stories, I do get so much meaning from my work, and that's what, you know, continues to push me in that.
And borrowing this concept from your line of work, regarding your activism,
mm-hmm.
how can you stay objective while supporting for the Palestinian cause and the people under oppression?
You know, it's very simple. You know, it's right and wrong. Like, it's wrong to commit mass murder. It's wrong to ethnically cleanse. You know, of course, I have my biases. We all have our biases. But, like, at the end of the day, like, it's just a very simple question. It's like good versus evil. It's right and wrong. Like, I think that no matter what your beliefs are, no matter what your biases, any rational person, any person with a heart and a soul, can see what's happening is just absolutely wrong.
And how does it make you feel when you hear the argument for self-defense that the Israelis are making? And
yeah.
you hear that a lot on mainstream
yeah.
media.
I mean, at this point, it's just laughable. You know, we see the images. I mean, they're not playing these images and these stories in Western media, because mainstream media is literally just a joke. At this point, it's so obnoxious and so ridiculous that I don't think really there's very many Americans, aside from Zionists and Christian nationalists, that take it seriously. Anyone who is paying attention and seeing the images on social media, the vast majority of victims are children, they're women, they're the elderly, the disabled, journalists, medical workers. Over like 1,500 healthcare workers at this point have been slaughtered. No one could ever make the argument that it's self-defense at this, you know, at any point, but especially at this point, 22 months of a live-streamed Holocaust.
Right.